Hey, what is up, you guys? I'm Allison.
I'm Katie.
And this is the Morning Hour podcast. Welcome back, everybody. It is a new week. I caught my rodent.
Yay! Biggest life update.
I know. I'm so excited for that. I felt a little bit pathetic because whenever I saw it, like, dead on the track. I'm sorry if any of you are like super against animal cruelty. I understand, but I'm all about loving animals and stuff like that, but not ones that can carry a disease to my one-year-old. I'm not about it. I'm sorry. I hope nobody's mad at me for wanting a rat out of my home. And I did not use a glue trap for those of you who are like, oh my God, you killed it inhumanely. It was quick. So I'm just saying, but I finally got it. It's out of my house. I'm thankful. I hope that we don't have any more. So yeah. Like I said, please don't hate me if you like expected me to like set it free. I'm sorry if I have a sickening feeling that if I were to let that thing free, it would have come back. It would have found its way back to us, because it took forever to catch. So anyway, don't hate me for protecting my family, but okay, let's move on from that.
Why would anybody hate you for that? The fact that you even have
because
to say that.
You would be so surprised how many people are so against killing rats and vermin and mice, which, I mean, I get it. You know, if I were a rat person, I would probably feel the same way. But no, I'm not. You know, people can get offended by what they get offended by. And, you know, who am I to say like what they are allowed to get offended by?
You're trying a little too hard to be politically correct right now.
This is probably true.
It's fine.
I just don't want to get canceled, okay? Cancel culture is very scary whenever you're, you know, doing a podcast or, you know, whatever, because any little thing you say can be twisted from people who don't actually know you.
It's true.
And know, like, your values and stuff. So, I mean, whenever we say certain things, I always have to have it in the back of my head, like, okay, I'm not talking to, you know, someone who knows me and speaks to me on a daily basis and who knows my good intentions behind everything that I say. You know what I mean?
That's a good thing to remember, but I just don't think we have to take it that far. Because, I mean,
you know,
the rat definitely chewed through like a fresh bag of tortillas and ate your tortillas. I think we can all get in line with the fact that that's not cool. And nobody wants rat tortillas.
Yeah, it ate through some of our tortillas. It also like chewed through the bottom of one of our doors in our kitchen. So it was a nuisance. It didn't just, you know, come and not do any damage. It did damage. So homeboy had to go. And I feel so embarrassed because I couldn't even get it out myself. Brad was out of town yesterday. And so I literally had to call one of my coworkers. I work from home, but I used to work in an actual warehouse. And I had to call them because we have screen printers and stuff. And the screen printer, one of the screen printers, anytime we've ever had like a mouse or something like that, he's been the one to take care of it. And so I called the office and I was like, hey, this might be a really weird question. I caught a rat. Is there any way that he can come pick it up, like dispose of it. I put on gloves. I had the trash bag. I couldn't grab it. No matter which way I tried to do the broom, I couldn't do it. I did not want to be anywhere near it. Mm-mm. And so it seemed pathetic, but thankfully he came and he took care of it for me. So the rat is out of the house. I pray there is no more. I don't want to deal with that again. And I don't even know how the little fucker got in our house to begin with, because I don't see any holes that they could have come in through.
Can't they like so flatten themselves to go through like really small spaces?
Apparently, so mice can fit through a hole the size of a dime, and rats can fit through a hole the size of a quarter, I think. So, I mean, they really don't need a ton of room to, you know, come in on. So, I don't know. I don't know how it came in. It could have, you know, scurried in while I was like bringing groceries inside. If I had the door wide open, you know, there's really no telling. But that is the end of my rat saga for now. Thank you for your interest. If you were interested, and if you don't give a shit, we're moving on.
Yeah.
How are you, Katie?
I am all right. I'm okay.
It's 9:30 in the morning. So are we waking up, or is that what's happening?
Kind of. I'm still drinking coffee. I'm trying to convince my brother currently. I'm texting while you're talking because I'm trying to convince my brother to come meet my new in-laws at this like little party we're doing today.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like,
are you having to convince him? Is it not working?
He's being very introverted about the situation. I'm like, bring your daughters, they have a pool, everyone's gonna be swimming. And he's like,
oh, that sounds heavenly.
He's like, but that requires meeting new people. And I'm like, you're going to meet
get
them.
Over it. I
know. He's like, I want to meet them, but he's like super introvert, so if anything's like short notice, he just like can't bring himself to do it if it involves like meeting new people and socializing.
But this is also the same guy who had only met me like once and then invited me to breakfast with both of you.
I know.
So
I guess if it's like one person, he's cool, but if it's like if he's maybe, gonna be outnumbered by people he doesn't know, he's like, oh no.
And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. I could understand that.
I mean, I'm kind of like that too, but he's like, I will meet them one day. Maybe I'll invite them to my house for a barbecue. And I'm like, why don't you expand your horizons and come?
Well, and that's the thing. He might just be like, okay, I'm comfortable in my home.
Uh-huh.
So they can come here where I'm comfortable. You know what I mean? It might be that kind of situation. I don't know.
It is. That's exactly
your,
what it is.
Your brother is He's a weird one.
He's an introvert, and he's like, I want to meet them, but today, ugh. And he's like, I just don't want to go anywhere. And I'm like, all right, whatever. It's fine.
Yeah.
I've been like arguing with him for the past like 10 minutes, like sending him texts.
Oh my God.
He's like, it just sounds
like
something.
Is your mom going to
go? No. He was like, it just sounds like something that I will do one day, but I'm not doing today. And I was like, okay, fine, whatever. He has all this like leftover food to eat from his like birthday party thing from last night.
Oh, that's true.
They catered Papado's. Yeah. So he's like, he's got like buckets of
fried
shrimp.
To cater Papado's for your birthday, you must be doing something right in your life, because guess what I had for my birthday? What did I have for my birthday? I had a local Mexican restaurant, I'm pretty sure, which I mean, it's fine. It's, you know, delicious, but. Yeah. If you're in, I don't know how many states Papado is in, but Papado is a very expensive seafood restaurant for those of you who are unaware. So
yeah, it was good. Tasty.
I haven't had Papado in years.
I had neither. It was the first time in a few, I think. So.
We have a lot to talk about, and it's gonna bum you the fuck out, so I'm sorry about it, but let's go ahead and just dive on in.
I mean, most of these stories we talk about are pretty
but this one's on a whole another level because of the sheer amount of botched fuckery that went into this case. This is not a case that is, how do I want to put this? This is not a case where I'm commending the police officers or any of the officials involved, aside from the like attorneys of the parents of the victim here. It's not something that I'm just like, I'm excited to talk about it in the aspect of spreading Ellen's story, but it's also one that's very frustrating. And as I was researching this, I was so dumbfounded. I kept having to like close my laptop and just like take a breather. And I was like, fuck, like how does one system completely just fuck over, like fuck a whole family over the way that the officials in this case did? So I'm going to go ahead and give a content warning here. This episode includes extensive discussion regarding suicide. So if that is something that you aren't really, you know, you don't really want to hear about, I completely understand. But it's mentioned a lot in this episode. So it's not something that I could just say, oh, go, like, you can skip forward or whatever. That is not in this case, because pretty much the majority of the case does include talk of suicide. So yeah, let's jump in. On which we already did, but we're jumping in even further now instead of just my prefacing. So on January 26th, 2011, so not even, it's been like 12 years, a 27-year-old teacher was found stabbed to death by her fiance in their Philadelphia apartment. Despite suffering multiple stab wounds, which we will talk about just how many stab wounds, her death was quickly determined to be a suicide, despite everything pointing to something far more sinister. This week is the mysterious death of Ellen Rae Greenberg. I went back and forth very hard on myself on if I wanted to just bite the bullet and call this the murder of Ellen Rae Greenberg. Her death is not, it's still technically under investigation. So I didn't want to bite the bullet and say the murder, even though as we go forward, it will be very obvious that this death is anything but mysterious. So yeah, let's get into the background of Ellen. So Ellen Rae Greenberg was born on June 23rd, 1983 in New York City. The only child to Dr. Josh Greenberg, a periodontist who practiced in Manhattan, and his wife, Sandy, who was a dental hygienist. Josh had met Sandy 5 years prior on a blind date, which they had it was a mutual friend who set them up on this blind date, and the rest is history. In 1994, the family relocated to Harrisburg, Philadelphia, which was Sandy's hometown. So she was from Harrisburg, Philadelphia, just going back to her roots kind of a situation. Partially due to the fact that Ellen was an only child, her and her parents were extremely close. And Josh recalls that Ellen was somewhat of a daddy's girl when she was growing up, as she loved attending sporting events with him, loved hanging out with him. And she was, you know, she was an all around sporty kind of girl. She played softball, you know, she was all about that kind of thing. Sandy later described Ellen in an interview with Oxygen as joyful, loving, warm, social, someone who liked to cook and loved fashion. So a lot of her friends also described her the same way. You know, she was full of passion, very driven. And she had a million-dollar smile, which if you look at pictures of her, that is 100% true. She smiles with her whole face. You know, you can really tell when she's happy. You know what I mean? So from a very young age, Ellen had a bright future to be whatever she set out to be. When she began attending Susquehanna Township High School in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, she was even a board member for the Hanna Educational Foundation, which was a nonprofit charitable organization whose mission is essentially helping the students of Susquehanna Township School District succeed. When she was trying to figure out what she wanted to pursue as a career, she considered speech pathology for a while, even graduating from Penn State with a degree in communications before ultimately deciding on becoming a teacher. The decision seemed really natural for Ellen, as her family describes her as someone who had an immense love for children. So back to school she went, this time to Temple University, gaining her master's degree in education with a reading specialist certification. Her passion for education and the students that she would one day teach was so evident that she was actually a founding teacher at Juniata Park Academy in Philadelphia and began teaching first grade in 2007. By all accounts, she was adored by all of her students. Her online memorial is filled with students that she once taught who remembers her joyful and all-around kind personality. A year after beginning her teaching career, she met a man named Sam Goldberg through a mutual friend, and the two severely hit it off after going on a blind date. Ironically enough, the same way, like they met the same way that her parents had met. So Sam was a television producer for NBC at the time, and the two quickly became serious, with everyone agreeing that they never really had like the awkward dating kind of stage that a lot of couples go through, you know, like the what's your favorite color? I swear to God, I'm so glad I'm married, because I do not think that I could go through that stage again. Like, what's your favorite food? What's your favorite color? What do you want to, you know, do with the rest of your life?
I don't remember asking anyone those questions. I don't know if I'm just like really bad.
I've always been a big 20 questions kind of person. Mm. Like, I will 20 questions the fuck out of a conversation.
I mean, I think I'm a question person too, because I drive Eric insane with that. So obviously,
you're definitely a question person, but you're not a simple question person. You're a very like deep philosophical question person.
That's what I was about to say. I think not that I'm deep, but I was gonna say I think like when I ask those questions to people I was on dates with, I feel like it was more like those kinds of questions, like more philosophical or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I remember talking about like science things with people and like
Katie.
With people who are interested in that back, you know, it wasn't just let me ramble about space or whatever. But
photosynthesis.
Like, yeah, no, sorry. Nothing like that. But
I don't
like,
know why photosynthesis came to mind.
Somebody would mention something like interesting, like a topic I was interested in or whatever. And then we would talk about that topic, you know, and it would be something maybe like knowledge related, like space or I don't know, something like that. But I don't remember the like doing the whole like awkward silence, oh what's your favorite color thing, you know, like
let me preface this a little bit better. I didn't say like in the awkward silence of a day like, oh so what's your favorite color. No, that was more of like a whenever I was like texting back and forth or like chatting back and forth before the first date, you know, because I wanted to have all that info before, you know, we got to the first date kind of a situation. But yeah, I don't know. I was big into like I had awkward stages with like pretty much everybody that I dated except for Brad.
Well, that's telling, I guess. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I also knew Brad before we started dating, so it wasn't like I was trying to get to know him. I already knew him, you know.
Yeah. You didn't have to go through the whole awkward like moments thing because you already knew this person, and so whenever you finally started talking in that way and like going on dates, it was kind of like I already sort of like know some of these things about you. So
yeah. It wasn't like a hi, I'm Allison, nice to meet you kind of a situation.
Yeah. Well, in my situation similar, like I worked in an art department with my fiance, so it was like we just were next to each other all the time. We were both graphic designers. We still work together, and so it's like the way you talk to people at work, you know, you get to know them or whatever. So it's like it wasn't like we started dating and then I have to ask all these questions. It's like I already kind of know these.
You already knew. Yeah. So that makes sense.
Yay for skipping the awkward stage.
Yay. I feel like we took a super long leeway just to get to that point.
It was fun.
So in 2010, Sam and Ellen, or she also went by Ellie. So sometimes I might interchangeably say Ellen or Ellie. Just really depends. So in 2010, Sam and Ellie went on a trip to California. And at the end of this trip, Sam actually proposed to Ellen on a beach. And there's this picture of Ellen like holding her hand up, showing her ring off. And she just looks like incredibly stoked. Like you can tell that she's just, you know, absolutely thrilled. So the couple started planning their wedding, and it was set to take place in August of 2011 at the Hotel Hershey, which is an upscale resort in Pennsylvania. And by all accounts, Sam and Ellen seemed very happy and excited for the future. But toward the end of 2010, Ellen began acting a little differently. She had been dealing with some anxiety, but when asked about it by her friends and family, she just contributed it to the wedding planning and her job. She was just feeling very overwhelmed and even talked about quitting her job and moving back in with her parents for a while in Harrisburg, which was 2 hours away from the Philadelphia apartment that she shared with Sam. So, you know, she's feeling this anxiety. She's feeling overwhelmed. She's considering, you know, moving back in with her parents. But when questioned, Ellen assured her parents that her wanting to do this, you know, her wanting to possibly move back in with them for a while had nothing to do with her relationship or her engagement with Sam, telling them that everything was okay in that regard. You know, she just needed to get away for a little bit. But Josh recalls that he had noticed some changes in Ellen, mainly when it came to making decisions. Instead of just making the decisions herself, she would say that she had to check with Sam. She had to see what Sam said about it. You know, she needed to always check with Sam before basically making any decisions for herself, which this was really unlike Ellen. She, you know, she was always the kind of person who was able to make decisions on her own. And I don't know firsthand, obviously, what the relationship was like. I will say that I'm not speculating that there was any abuse in the relationship, because we'll find out that Ellen actually says otherwise. I will say that whenever I myself was in an abusive relationship, I felt very isolated. I felt like I couldn't do anything on my own without making sure that it was okay with this specific person, you know, so I could kind of see how people would think, oh, that's weird. You know, like for someone who goes from being completely independent to saying, oh, well, I need to check with Sam. I need to double check to see what Sam says, you know? So when, on top of all the anxiety that she had been facing, Ellen began having trouble sleeping, her parents urged her to seek professional help just to get to the bottom of it, you know, just to see what was going on. And so she did. She began to see psychiatrist Dr. Ellen Berman. They share the same first name, so I'm going to be referring to the psychiatrist as Dr. Berman, just so we know, you know, the difference there. So she met with Dr. Berman a total of 3 times, her first appointment being on January 12th, 2011. And at this appointment, she was prescribed Zoloft and a low dose of Xanax. But when this combination did not end up working for her, Ellen was prescribed Klonopin, which is a benzodiazepine used to treat seizures, panic disorder, and anxiety, and Ambien, which is a sedative to help her sleep. So she was prescribed these 2 things, and I will say that both of these drugs can cause suicidal ideation, but Dr. Berman made a point to write in Ellen's chart that she was in no way suicidal and was, in fact, excited for her upcoming wedding. Shortly after she began taking these medications, she expressed to her mom that she felt like they were working and that she was feeling good. And, you know, she was just super excited about it and had even sent out the save the dates for her and Sam's upcoming wedding on January 22nd, 2011, and made plans for Sam's birthday the next weekend. So she started this medication. First of all, let me just say, she recognized that there was a problem. And she didn't just sit back and do nothing about it. You know, she started experiencing anxiety, which she had never done before. She had never experienced that before. And so she did something about it. She decided that she was going to, you know, seek help for it. It wasn't like she was like, oh, well, I'm just going to let it fester and let it get worse. So just as I'm going through all of this, keep everything that I'm saying in mind about her mental state, because this will come back continuously. Just 4 days later, on Wednesday, January 26th, 2011, Philadelphia was experiencing a very snowy day with a winter storm blowing in. So it was just going to get worse throughout the day. But Ellen went to work as normal, talking to her mom on the phone as she drove to school. And according to Sandy, nothing out of the ordinary came from the conversation. They talked about taxes since tax season was right around the corner. But other than that, it was a really typical conversation. Considering the weather was not letting up anytime soon, the school decided to have an early release day for the kids so, you know, they could get home before the worst of the storm. So Ellen finished up at school and headed back to her and Sam's apartment, filling up her car with gas on the way so her gas line didn't freeze, which I didn't know was even a thing because Texas.
Yeah.
So Ellen and Sam lived at the Venice Loft apartment, which is now called Apex, and it's on Flat Rock Road in Manayunk, which is a neighborhood in Philadelphia. But their specific unit was a two-bedroom apartment on the sixth floor of the building. So six stories high, okay? So Ellen returned home around 1 p.m., and at some point that afternoon, Sam arrived back to their apartment as well. Sam claims that around 4:45 that evening, he decided to go for a workout at the gym that was located in the Venice Loft apartment complex, and that when he left, Ellen was fine, nothing unusual about her, anything like that. But when he returned to their apartment between 30 to 45 minutes later, between 5:15 and 5:30, he found that the door was locked from the inside, and even more so, the security swing lock had been secured and he was unable to enter. So we're going to talk about the swing lock here in a little bit, but whenever I mention the lock, it's a U-bar swing lock, kind of like the ones that you would see in like a hotel room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So that's the kind of lock that's on their door. Okay. So he tried knocking on the door to get Ellen to open up. And when that didn't work, he began to yell her name through the door, but he received no response. Neighboring residents of the complex would later tell the police that they had heard Sam trying to gain entry into the apartment and to, like, he was trying to get her to open the door, but nobody stepped outside of their own apartment to actually see what was happening. At this point, Sam began sending Ellen text messages that are time-stamped to have been sent one after the other between 5:32 p.m. and 5:54 p.m. And they start off pretty normal. He said, "Hello, open the door, what are you doing?" And then it gets weird, okay? He says, "I'm getting pissed. Hello, you better have an excuse. What the fuck? Ah, and then you have no idea." So
wouldn't you be more like worried that something had happened to her?
Thank you. If I ever got locked out of the house or like for whatever reason, like if Brad did like secure the swing lock or whatever and I was unable to get in, I'd be like, are you like,
dead
I'd be
in
like,
there?
Hello, are you okay? Yeah. I wouldn't be like pissed, you know? And I mean, especially after it's been 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Or 20 minutes that he's out there.
I'd be,
you know,
like,
I mean?
Concerned they, like, slipped in the shower and, like, cracked
Thank
their head
you.
Open or something.
Thank
like,
you. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, and I'm just going to say the you have no idea. You can read that a couple different ways. Okay. It could sound threatening. You know, you could look at it like you have no idea what I'm going to do when it. Like what I'm going to do to you when I get inside, or like you have no idea how pissed I am. Or it could also be like, you have no idea that I'm even out here. You know, like you have no idea I'm even locked out.
That's true. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's hard to read a text message with a certain, you know, vernacular, I guess.
Yeah,
whenever
you can
there's
kind of ascribe whatever tone to it that you want, I guess. You know?
Yeah. I mean, but whenever you pair it with the I'm getting pissed,
yeah,
you know, kind of a thing, it takes it to another. And like the you better have an excuse, like that sounds kind of threatening to me.
It does, yeah. Yeah, why is your inclination, you know, that she would lock you out on purpose and not that something might have happened to her? Are you the kind of person that deserves to be locked out? Did you do something to her? You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, you know, yeah. It's.
I'm not saying it's okay to lock your significant other out, but what I'm saying is...
No. But it's also, it's, to me, it's weird because it's like, okay, like you said, if for some reason I ended up locked out of my house, I would be more worried than upset.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of it more,
you know,
in the
I'd be
light.
More worried than pissed.
Yeah, I'm thinking of it more in the light of like, is she afraid of him and so she locked him out or something? You know what I'm saying? Like physically afraid or whatever. Not just like, I'm locking you out because I'm pissed and toxic or whatever, but like, because his reaction seems to be that he thinks it's that, like she's locking him out on purpose. And it's like, why would someone do that to you? You know?
Yeah.
Instead of.
It's just the whole you better have an excuse that I'm getting pissed, that you have no idea. It except for, I mean, the last one can be viewed a couple of different ways, but the "you better have an excuse" and the "I'm getting pissed," it's kind of hard to read those any different way.
Yeah.
Besides for like, okay, you aggressive. Better have an excuse as to why the fuck I'm locked out and I'm getting pissed that you're, you know, not, you know, letting me in.
Yeah.
Instead of like, are you okay? What's happened? Are you, you know, did you fall? Mm-hmm. Did you hurt yourself? Like, what, you know what I mean? It's weird. I'm not suggesting anything. I'm just saying the text messages are odd.
Suspicious. Yeah.
Yeah. So after all of his strategies failed up until that point, Sam went down to the main floor to speak to the only security guard on duty, Philip Hanton, to see if he could help him gain entry into the unit. But Sam thought that maybe they had some kind of tool that could be used to open the swing lock from the outside. But Philip told Sam that they didn't have anything like that and that it was against company policy to help him break into his apartment. Sam made a point to tell Philip multiple times that he was just returning from the complex's gym. And this kind of struck Philip as odd, considering Sam wasn't wearing what you would consider to be workout appropriate attire, as he was wearing like what Philip Hanton would later consider Timberland boots. It's not really something that you would see if you're like working out.
No.
And it doesn't seem like he would actually need to change like into any kind of, it didn't seem like he would need to change out from like workout clothes to like regular clothes, considering the gym was in the complex. So it's not like he was actually having to get out into the snowstorm or anything like that. So I could be wrong. I don't know. I'm not somebody who regularly works out. So
me neither.
So Sam then asked Philip if he could just bust through the door himself, and Philip was basically like, I mean, yeah, I guess, but you would be liable for any damages that were, you know, done. So Sam headed back up to the sixth floor apartment that he shared with Ellen and did just that. He quote unquote broke the door down. Okay, we'll talk about this more in a bit, but he broke the door down. Sam would later tell police that the security guard actually came with him for this, that he actually came up and witnessed him break the door down, but Philip Hanton told a completely different story, claiming to have stayed at his post the entire time because he was the only security guard on duty, and he could have gotten fired if he left his post unattended. You know what I mean? When Sam gets into the apartment, it's around 6:30 p.m. So keep in mind, he got back at the house between 5:15 and 5:30. It's been an hour since he's been able to gain entry into the apartment. So he gets into the apartment and he finds Ellen on the kitchen floor, located just inside of the front door entrance. She was sitting upright, slumped with her upper half resting against the lower half of the kitchen cabinets next to the oven, bloodied and not moving. At 6:33 p.m., Sam called 911, but it would later be discovered that 911 was not the first call that he made when he found Ellen. First, he called his parents, and then he called his uncle by marriage, James Schwartzman, who just so happened to be a very connected lawyer, who in 2021 was actually elected president judge of the Pennsylvania Court of Judicial Discipline. And what the judges of the Court of Judicial Discipline do is that they're basically tasked with hearing and deciding charges of misconduct filed against judicial officers. So just keep that in mind. His uncle is very connected, okay? I will say that these phone records have not been made public, but in every source that I've read, it is said this. It is specified that these are two phone calls that he made. So I'm going to play the 911 call for you guys because I think that it will help you understand why a lot of people have an issue with his narrative of what actually happened. Multiple people have said it's a very bad acting job. So I'm going to play it for you and I'm going to let you decide that for yourself. Okay?
I just walked to my apartment. My fiance's on the floor with blood everywhere.
What is the address?
4601 Flat Rock Road. Please come. Help.
4601
Flat Rock Road.
Is this a house or apartment?
Oh, no.
It's
an apartment.
What apartment number?
Please hurry, please.
Where is she bleeding from?
I don't know. I can't tell.
No. So you have to calm yourself down in order to get you some help.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at her right now. I can't see anything. There's nothing broken. She's bleeding. Ellie.
You don't know where she's bleeding from. Can't see where the blood's coming from.
I think her head. I think she hit her head. But it's up everywhere. It's everywhere.
Think she might have fallen. Do you know what happened?
She may have slipped. There's blood on the table. Her face is a little purple.
Okay, hold on for rescue for her. Stay on the phone. Philadelphia Fire Department 842. What's the address? No,
4601 Flat Rock Road. Please hurry.
4601 Flat Rock?
Yes.
What's wrong?
I went downstairs to go work out. I came back up. The door was latched. My fiance's inside. She wasn't answering. So after about a half hour, I decided to break it down. I see her now just on the floor with blood. She's not responding.
Okay, is she breathing? Look at her chest. I need you to calm down, and I need you to look at her chest. It's really.
I really don't think she is.
Listen to me. Someone's on the way. Look at her chest. Is she flat on her back?
She's on her back.
Look at her chest and tell me if it's going up and down, up and down.
I don't see her moving.
Okay, do you know how to do CPR?
I don't.
Okay, I can tell you what to do, okay, until they get there. I want you to keep her flat.
Oh, God.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, okay.
Are you willing to do CPR with me over the phone until they get there?
I have to, right?
Okay, so get her flat on her back, bare her chest, okay? You want to rip her shirt off. Okay, she needs to kneel down by her side.
Oh my God, Ellie, please.
Listen, you can't freak out, sir, because you
okay, I'm trying not to, Her shirt won't come off, it's a zipper.
Rip
oh my
off.
God, she stabbed herself.
Where?
She fell in a knife. Oh no, her knife's sticking out.
Her what?
There's a knife sticking out of her heart.
Oh, she stabbed herself?
I guess so, I don't know where she fell on it, I don't know.
Okay, well, don't touch it.
Okay, I'll just let her down. What do I do?
No, I mean, you can't, if the knife is at her chest, it's going to be kind of hard for you to do CPR at this time.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Police, which operator?
277.
Is someone coming here?
Yes, they are. You said 4601 Flat Rock, right?
Yes.
Okay, someone's on the way. And the knife is still inside?
Which or what?
The knife is still inside of her?
Yes, I didn't take it out.
Was it her chest or what area?
It looks like it's right in her heart.
Okay, someone's on the way out there. Okay, just get.
Oh my God!
How old is she?
She's 27.
27, and there's no sign of life at all.
No, please don't be. What?
Then turn to her arm and tell me if she responds to pain.
She's not, her arm and her hands are still warm. I don't know what that means, but there's blood everywhere.
I know, but you can't, and the knife is still inside of her. How far? Can you see how far it went in?
It looks pretty deep.
Okay. So that's all I'm going to play of that. Let's talk about this, okay?
Okay.
First of all, whenever the 911 operator tells him that she's going to walk him through CPR, and he says, I have to, right? Like, he almost doesn't want to do it.
Yeah, she said something like, are you going to, or something like that, right? And he said, well, I have to, right?
Yeah, she said, are you willing to do CPR with me over the phone? And he says, I have to, right?
I mean, he might just be the woman, freaked out about not knowing how.
Maybe,
you know,
but if this is the woman that you're supposed to love and like that you're set to be married to in a few months, you know, wouldn't you be like absolutely willing to try to do anything instead of, acting like I have to, right?
Mm-hmm.
As if it's like a chore that you feel like inconvenienced in doing.
Yeah, that's strange.
You know, also, he says multiple times that he's looking at her, that he's doing this. And it takes close to 3 minutes into the 911 call for him to notice or mention the kitchen knife that we will come to find has a 10-inch handle on it that is sticking out of her chest. Okay?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, he finds this knife that's in her chest, and then he's very quick to say, she stabbed herself, or she fell on the knife. What?
Yeah. I thought it was strange that he, like, didn't see the knife, and then like all of a sudden he saw the knife. Like, where?
Yeah. And it's a kitchen knife. It's yeah. not like a
pocket knife.
It's not like a tiny pocket knife or switch. It is a kitchen knife with a, like I said, a 10-inch handle on it. So the 10-inch handle is sticking out of her chest. Mm-hmm. And you mean to tell me that you didn't see that until 3 minutes into the 911 call if you've been looking at her this entire time?
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
And you're meaning to tell me that your first inclination whenever you see this knife is that she stabbed herself? Or that she fell on a knife?
Yeah. I mean, I could see thinking maybe she fell on it. Like, if it wasn't you and there's no one else there and you see that she's got a knife in her chest, I would be like, either someone did this to her or she fell.
But she's sitting. She's sitting upright.
Oh, okay. Well, then
like,
no.
She's against the cabinets. It's not like she's laying on the knife.
Yeah.
You know
and how
I mean?
How did he not see the knife if she was just been sitting against the cabinets this whole time? That doesn't
and
make
she's
sense.
And she's a very small girl. Like, she's a yeah. very skinny woman. So it's not like she has, you know, I don't even know why that would matter. But her chest is not, you know, she doesn't have like big chest or anything like that. Yeah. So it's not like
there's nothing that would conceal a knife. Yeah, exactly.
No, especially a 10-inch knife.
No.
Like, no. Okay. I guess my thought process would be like, wouldn't it be more like, wouldn't you say she was attacked? If you see this knife sticking out of her chest, there was no evidence that she fell on it. You know, there was no evidence of anything else besides just her being stabbed. So... okay. So that was the 911 call. Okay. Let's continue. According to Tom Brennan, a former state police trooper of 25 years who now works as a pro bono private investigator for the Greenberg family in regards to Ellen's case, EMS and fire were the first to arrive on the scene, and they went up, found Sam sitting in the hallway, made entry into the apartment, and pronounced Ellen dead at 6:40 p.m. Police officers arrived at the scene, and EMS and fire were dismissed. And it's to be noted that EMS and fire were never interviewed. Okay. Typically, if there's a suspected homicide, they will investigate, like they will interview every single person who was in attendance at the scene. Fire, EMS, detect everybody who has touched this case or has touched the scene will be interviewed. There was no kind of interview for fire and EMS. Okay. So when police arrived, they found Ellen in the same way that Sam had, sitting upright, slumped with her upper half resting against the lower half of the kitchen cabinets. However, it's to be noted that there was a straight line of blood running horizontally from Ellen's nostril to the back of her ear, as if she was laying down whenever she received this particular injury. Okay. It's also to be noted that there was blood on her shirt, on her pants, and on her UGG boots that she was wearing. So keep all of this in mind. There was a knife embedded in her left chest through her clothing. Two clean kitchen knives were found in the sink with a knife block that was overturned on the kitchen counter next to the sink. It appeared as if the knife in her chest was part of a knife set that was stored in this knife block. Okay. There was a clean white bathroom towel in her left hand. So this towel was completely pristine. It had no blood on it whatsoever. And a pair of eyeglasses were on the ground to her right. On the kitchen counter, there was a strainer filled with fresh fruit and an orange on the counter that was in the process of being cut. There was no evidence of a struggle in the apartment, and nothing of value had been taken, despite there being plenty of items that held value, such as a laptop on the kitchen island that happened to be Sam's, and two laptops in the bedroom, one of which being Ellen's personal laptop, due to the fact that the screen was open with a wedding planning site on it, and the other being her work laptop, due to the presence of teaching materials found on it. In addition to the two laptops, Ellen's engagement ring was also found in the bedroom. So there was nothing of value taken, you know, so they're trying to figure out if it was possible that, you know, an intruder could have come in or something like that. So according to police reports, Sam remained on the scene and was cooperative, and his family, who had also arrived on the scene, supported Sam as he gave his statement to police. Sam told police that he broke down the door to the apartment with the help of Philip Hanton, but we have already established that Philip Hanton claimed to have never left his post, as he was the only security guard on duty. Sam was handcuffed and taken to the police station for further questioning, where he gave a brief statement with his attorney present. But other than that, he was released. Okay, it's to be noted that Ellen's family, along with the experts and private detectives that the Greenbergs hired following Ellen's death, have not been given access to a lot of the police reports, this interview with Sam included. So this is just one of the many things that is so infuriating about it, because the family has tried so hard to get Ellen's case seriously looked at, and it feels like time and time again, it's just being either swept under the rug or they're not being given the full story. So before we get into what injuries Ellen actually suffered that led to her death, I want to make it clear that from the get-go, police looked at the death of Ellen Greenberg as a suicide, despite the fact that in the police report, it is stated that there was no suicide note or any indicative sign of suicide found on her computer or at the scene. Remember this. Due to the fact that they believed that it was a suicide right from the jump, the scene at the apartment wasn't treated with the care that it would have been if they were processing a homicide, okay? According to former homicide prosecutor for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, Guy D'Andrea, when asked if the apartment was ever treated as a crime scene at all, Guy states, quote, "I mean, it was, and the extent that a crime scene unit arrived, the medical examiner arrived, it was photographed, but I can tell you from my experience as a homicide prosecutor, it wasn't treated with the level that an investigation would be treated if viewed by the authorities as a homicide," end quote. So from the get-go, they're like, oh, suicide, obviously. Like, come on. So, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, quote, "Police said they treated Greenberg's death as a suicide that night because the apartment door, which her fiancé said that he broke down, had been locked from the inside. Greenberg had no defensive wounds to indicate that she tried to fight off an attacker, and there were no signs of an intruder in the apartment," end quote. And this is where I'm going to mention that the only entrance and exit to the apartment unit was the front door and the door leading out to the balcony. But again, they were six stories high, and the snow on the balcony had been undisturbed, so it wasn't likely for anyone to have come in or out that way anyway, you know, unless they knew how to fly, you know, it wasn't really possible. So, and we will talk more about the lock that was engaged on the front door here in a little bit, okay? So Sam's father called Ellen's parents later that evening to let them know that something awful had happened to their daughter. And not only were they 2 hours away from where Ellen lived, the snow made it pretty much impossible to rush down to be with her daughter. Ellen's mother, Sandy, recalls finding out about Ellen's death, stating, quote, "All I know is my world went dark and I have no daughter," end quote. And that fucking just like wrecked me. Ellen's body was transported for autopsy the following morning on January 27, 2011. Assistant medical examiner Marlon Osborne performed the autopsy, and in his preliminary autopsy report, it was concluded that she suffered 20 stab wounds.
Okay.
One to her stomach, 8 to her chest, 1 to the back of her head that went directly into her brain, and on the back of her head, she also had a 6-centimeter gash on the back of her head, and 10 additional stab wounds to the back of her neck.
Oh my God.
So she had, most of the stab wounds were to the back of her neck. She had a gash on the back of her head as well. She had a stab wound in the back of her head going so deep that it, you know, it went into her brain. Yeah, so keep this in mind. She was stabbed 20 times, okay? The stab wounds varied in depth, some being as shallow as 0.2 centimeters to as deep as 10 centimeters. So some are, you know, kind of shallow. Some are very deep. These wounds would cause injury to her heart, the upper lobe of her left lung, and her liver. One of the wounds had penetrated Ellen's cranial cavity, severing the cranial nerves and brain. This injury alone would have caused extreme pain and loss of mobility and consciousness. Keep in mind that the knife was found in her chest, so it's safe to say that this was the last wound that she suffered from, right? you know, so how could she stab herself in the chest if the stab to her brain, you know, did so much damage?
Yeah.
It was also noted that Ellen had 11 bruises throughout her body, such as on her hips, her inner and outer thighs, her arms, and around both of her wrists. All of these bruises were in various stages of healing, and it is said that these bruises were the type that you would see that could have been caused by contact sports, which she didn't play contact sports, and I'm not sure what sports would cause bruising around someone's wrists, but okay. So just keep this in mind, okay? I think someone ended up saying that the bruises that they saw were evidence of a repeat physical altercation. So in this draft of the autopsy report, Osborne concluded that the manner of death was a homicide. Okay. So in the original autopsy report, the medical examiner saying, okay, yeah, she was murdered. This is not a suicide. She was murdered. So a few other things took place on January 27th as well. Sam Goldberg's uncle, James Schwartzman, contacted the Venice Loft's property manager, Melissa Weir, to see if he could retrieve some of Sam's personal items from Sam and Ellen's apartment. Melissa called the Philadelphia police to ensure that this was okay, and Melissa was told that at the time there were no restrictions on who could go into the apartment, despite the fact that it had been less than 24 hours since Ellen was found dead, and considering it was technically still a crime scene. Melissa was also informed that police were not responsible for any cleanup of the crime scene and that she was to hire a third-party company, and she was given the recommendation to call a company called Crime Scene Cleanup to have them take care of it for her. So she did, and made arrangements for them to come clean Ellen's apartment, and then she called James Schwartzman to let him know that he could come whenever the apartment was finished being cleaned to gather whatever he needed. But Melissa also made a point to ensure that the condition of the inside of Ellen's apartment was videotaped, just so she had a record to show the contents of the apartment, you know, the condition, to cover Venice Lofts and crime scene cleanup in case there was any damage done or any theft or anything like that. So she was just trying to cover her own ass, basically. The items that James Schwartzman took out of the apartment consisted of a suit for Sam to wear to Ellen's funeral, which, okay, that's fine. But then he also took all three of the laptops and Ellen's cell phone. Yeah, the laptops and cell phone were turned over to police 2 days later, but by that point, the chain of evidence was, like, broken, you know, meaning that anything now found on them is inadmissible in court, basically. So, the fuck, okay? So, and also, can I just say, this also goes to show that police really just said suicide from the jump, because it's not even 24 hours later, and they're like, okay, yeah, you can definitely just clean up the crime scene. Just get rid of everything that points to what actually happened here.
Great.
The same day, police spoke with Ellen's psychiatrist, Dr. Ellen Berman, and Dr. Berman told investigators that Ellen was a new patient of hers, and she, you know, she'd only seen her 3 times and had an appointment scheduled for that very day, the day after Ellen's death. Dr. Berman told them that Ellen had presented as having severe anxiety for the last 2 months, and during their sessions, Dr. Berman gathered that Ellen was having difficulty with work after the school district, you know, changed some regulations, and that she was overwhelmed and felt under pressure. She also said that Ellen expressed having issues with difficult students and that she wasn't sure if she should quit and find a new job or just work through it. So none of what Ellen told Dr. Berman seemed out of the ordinary as far as anxiety goes. It wasn't like she was considering ending her own life due to this stress. You know, she was just trying to figure out if she should stay at her current job or find something different. You know, it wasn't like she was showing any kind of like depression or anything like that, or like, you know, I just can't do it anymore. I'm thinking about just ending it. There was none of that. So Dr. Berman also told investigators that Ellen had no bad words to say about Sam, denying any abuse in the relationship. She also expressed excitement about the upcoming wedding and even smiled when Sam was mentioned. But again, Dr. Berman wrote in Ellen's chart that she was not suicidal and told this to investigators. So Ellen was laid to rest on January 28th, 2011 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and considering the medical examiner's preliminary autopsy report labeled the manner of death as a homicide, Ellen's case was turned over to the Philadelphia Homicide Unit for further investigation. While security cameras confirmed that everyone who entered and exited the building around the time of Ellen's death either lived at or worked at the complex, there were no security cameras in the hallways leading to the apartments, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Sam's electronic key fob usage was looked into as well, and this corroborated his story of leaving, coming back, etc. DNA analysis came back, and there was no other DNA found on the knife that was embedded into Ellen's chest, except for Ellen's herself. Okay? Her toxicology report also came back completely clear of everything, except for trace amounts of Ambien, which was more than likely from the night before, and her prescribed amount of Klonopin. Police claimed that the medical examiner also consulted with neuropathologist Dr. Lucy Rourke to see if it was possible for Ellen to have had continued injuring herself after suffering severe wounds to the back of her neck and head. So even though it's technically a homicide at this point, they're still trying to figure out how they can spin it to be a suicide. Okay. In February of 2011, police reported that they sent a portion of Ellen's spinal cord to Dr. Rourke for examination, and police concluded that based on Dr. Rourke's findings, that while the knife did come in contact with her spinal cord, it was not severe enough to cause paralysis, but it could have caused Ellen to experience tingling and numbness, making it difficult or impossible for her to feel the pain that was caused by her continuing to stab herself. You know, like I said, while this is now being investigated as a homicide, they're still acting as if it was suicide. And it just makes no sense. So, as published in newspapers on February 1st, 2011, quote, "The medical examiner's office ruled the death as a homicide based on the Philadelphia Police Department's announcement on January 28th. A few days later, the police department backed away, making a statement that the case had not been ruled a homicide and was still being investigated as suspicious," end quote. And I'm just going to say, it's very, very, very rare for the police to go against the medical examiner's findings. Because, I mean, you can't negate science whenever it comes to certain things. You know what I mean?
No.
So it's very rare for police to say, oh, the medical examiner said homicide? No, we're going suicide with this. It's rare.
Yeah.
But at some point between January 17th, when this preliminary autopsy report was drafted, and February 18th, when the official report was made, Marlon Osborne had a meeting with representatives of the Philadelphia Police Department, the district attorney, and the chief medical examiner, Dr. Sam Galino. And according to Osborne, due to the lack of defensive wounds and the official February 18th autopsy report, Ellen's manner of death was changed to suicide, closing the investigation. So basically, the medical examiner who did her autopsy had a little meeting with police, and suddenly, it's been changed to suicide.
Wow.
Okay. So the very first line in the official autopsy report is, quote, "The decedent is a 27-year-old female with a history of anxiety," end quote. A history of 2 months? That's a history of anxiety for you? 2 months?
Wow. Well,
I'm sorry. I could be very wrong here and very off base here, but I find it very hard to believe that someone who struggles with anxiety for 2 months is just going to end it all.
No, I've been struggling with anxiety for years.
I've been struggling. Yeah.
And
like
I'm not going to off myself. So it's like, Yeah, no. She had like very situational anxiety about like
exactly.
her job.
And it wasn't like, oh, I just have anxiety. I'm feeling intense doom at every turn with everything I do.
Yeah.
No, it was situational.
And honestly, that's all BS because like everyone experiences anxiety, but not everyone
experiences anxiety.
Not
to
everyone
some degree,
has
yes.
an anxiety disorder. And so just blanketing the term anxiety because somebody was experiencing situational anxiety is not fair to her. It's acting like she had an anxiety disorder when she was actually just experiencing like general human anxiety at a certain experience that she was having. It's completely different than having like unfounded anxiety as a disorder, which you and I both like deal with. So we know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, that's not fair at all to put that on her report. Like she had some disorder when she was just like a stressed out teacher. Like, oh yeah, totally a motive for offing yourself. Like, no, absolutely not.
Especially considering, I mean, if you think about it, she was trying to get help for it. It wasn't something like she, you know what I mean? It wasn't something that she was like
silently struggling with. Yeah.
Yeah. And it, she obviously knew that she could control it to a degree, or else she wouldn't think that, she, you know, seeing a psychiatrist would help.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to say, stabbing yourself 20 times in the back of the neck, and it's hardly the way that most people would choose to end it.
No.
Especially a woman. You know, women are more, they're statistically more likely to choose the most painless and least messy way to end their own life if they choose to do so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like
women don't typically shoot themselves as much.
Yeah, they, it's typically like asphyxiation or overdosing or something like that. It's and again, I mean, which I know we just talked about Jodi Arias, but in the same note, women are more likely to be like poisoners. Like if they're like a murderer, they're more than likely to be poisoners over, you know, using a knife or a gun or whatever, you know.
It's
so
it's less aggression and like,
yes,
go out with a bang. It's more of a silent thing. So,
yeah. I'm also going to go out on a limb here and say that if someone was going to take their own life in this way, like by stabbing, why are they going for the back of the neck?
I don't know. I mean, we've all seen plays and movies where someone kills themselves with a dagger or something, and typically they just run it up into their heart and fall on it, right? Like,
yeah.
One fell swoop and it's over. Like, what crazy person would just like butcher themselves, you know? Like, that's no one does
like,
that.
Like, okay. And I get that she was stabbed in the stomach and the heart. I get that. But that was only one, or that was only like two of her wounds.
Yeah. What about the other 18?
Yeah. You know, she was stabbed in the back of the neck. She was stabbed in the back of the head. She had a gash in the back of her head, like a long gash in the back of her head.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
That's an attack. It's nearly impossible to do that to yourself.
But they're focusing on the fact that she had anxiety, so she must have done this to herself. And it's insulting.
That is insulting.
As someone who's had anxiety for over a decade, you know, like just because someone has anxiety doesn't mean that they're a suicide risk.
Yeah. It's not like, fair to like throw a diagnosis out there all the time as like the reason why somebody must have offed themselves, because especially we were saying, she had situational anxiety. It wasn't even like some chronic long-term like irrationality or anything. It was just,
and
like,
the thing is, like, okay, she was stressed out about planning her wedding. That's a good anxiety. That's like a good situation to be like stressed about. You know, it's not like you're so stressed out that you're, you know, you can't function. You know, she was going to work, and even the teacher who took over after Ellen's death said that her work, like, because she had to look at her lesson plan, she had to look at her grade book, everything like that, because she was taking over. She said that everything was in perfect order. It was in, you know, there was nothing that would indicate that she was struggling.
She wasn't,
you know,
experiencing like irrational anxiety, undue paranoias, things like that. And even
she was having some trouble with the new, you know, whatever I keep wanting to say guidelines, but I know that that's not the thing. I said it earlier. She was having trouble with the new, the changes that the school district had made. She had some trouble with some difficult students.
Yeah.
I had trouble with difficult students. I was a fucking student myself.
Like, very logical, you know, rational, like, problems.
Being a teacher is not easy.
Yeah.
I've never been a teacher, obviously, but holy shit. Yeah. I know some teachers, and it's not an easy job. It is a very, very, it can be a very, very stressful job.
Yeah.
And if she was having trouble in this particular school district, she was probably just considering if she wanted to go to another one.
Yeah.
It wasn't, and she probably just felt like she couldn't make that decision on her own. So she wanted to talk to a professional to see what they would recommend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like she was like, oh man, these kids just make me want to die. Like, no. Okay. I'm glad we could agree on that. Mm-hmm. The fact that they're like, but the fact that that was the first sentence in her autopsy report made my blood boil.
Yeah, that's insulting.
But let's talk about the no defensive wounds thing, okay? If she had her back turned to whoever was attacking her, you know, probably while she was cutting fruit, if we believe what the scene originally told us before it was professionally cleaned, and if in one of the first strikes to her, you know, she was immediately paralyzed because her spinal cord was hit, of course there would be no fucking defensive wounds.
Yeah. She couldn't, you know, do anything.
That's if terrible. She was immediately hit in the back of the neck, like, come on. And I'm sorry, in my opinion, the knife block being overturned, that seems like kind of a struggle to me.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be a huge struggle, but it's a struggle, you know? Yeah.
There was some sort of, like, movement there.
Scuffle. There was something that happened there. And the fact that there was a gash on the back of her head, I mean, that might not look like a defensive wound, but to me, it seems like it could have been. You
like
know,
maybe she moved or like jerked her head and the knife was behind her and it or something, you know, I don't know. Definitely no, there's no fingers pointing to she did this to herself, like none.
And I'm just going to say it. Police were so dead set on calling this a suicide that when they found out that the medical examiner originally called it a homicide, they knew they fucked up. You know, because at that point, they allowed the crime scene to be totally cleaned as if it was an open and shut case of suicide. They allowed possible evidence to be taken out of the home, breaking that chain of evidence. So what the hell are they going to investigate at this point? How do you investigate a cleaned and disinfected crime scene?
Yeah, you don't.
Like,
there's literally nothing that points to that being a suicide. I mean, even at first, like, look, even at first glance at the situation, nothing about that screams suicide. Everything about it screams murder. And then, like, the farther you look into it, the more it sounds like murder. So it's like,
the only thing that they are basing their findings off of is the fact that the door was locked.
It's like, okay, and
that's just the testimony of one person.
Yeah,
that the door was locked.
And who was in there with her?
Well, apparently nobody.
A phantom. A ghost stabbed her.
Fuck.
All right.
All right. So, unfortunately, Ellen's parents found out that her death was ruled a suicide due to the media and not because anyone actually called them to tell them.
Wow.
Josh and Sandy never once believed that Ellen was capable of suicide or hurting herself at all. They claimed that while Ellen had been struggling with anxiety, she was still happy and there was, you know, never a reason to suspect suicide in any way, shape, or form. Also mentioning that Ellen was known to be squeamish and had a very low pain tolerance. You know, so the idea of her doing this to herself seemed unfathomable, you know. It's also to be noted that victims of suicide by stabbing typically do not stab themselves over their clothing, according to Chief County Coroner and Dean of the School of Health Sciences of the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, Gregory McDonald. McDonald did say that Ellen's superficial wounds could be consistent with suicide, stating in an interview with Oxygen, quote, when someone is self-inflicting these wounds, sometimes they'll stab themselves superficially first to kind of see what it feels like to them, and then they'll go deeper and deeper as they progress with these self-inflicted wounds, end quote. He did mention that the deeper stab wounds and other markings presented more as a knife attack rather than a suicide, though. So, just laying that out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, unable to accept the fact that Ellen could have done this to herself, her parents started their own investigation and hired their own lawyer, Larry Krasner. They were able to get the autopsy report as well as crime scene photos and hired Tom Brennan, as we've discussed. They also had many renowned forensic pathologists, including Cyril Wecht and forensic scientist Henry Lee, to take a look at Ellen's autopsy, and they all concluded that her injuries are more indicative of homicide rather than suicide, with Cyril Wecht stating, quote, "I don't understand how they wrote this off as a suicide," end quote. Just in case you're curious on who like Cyril Wecht is, if you don't know him or his credentials, he has been the president of both the American Academy of Forensic Sciences and the American College of Legal Medicine, and headed the board of trustees of the American Board of Legal Medicine. He's probably most famous for his involvement in the JFK assassination investigation. He was the first civilian ever given permission to examine the evidence. And he's the one who first discovered that JFK's brain, as well as all related data to the killing, had gone missing. So he was very, you know, very involved in the JFK investigation. So we should cover that one day.
Yeah, we should.
I never thought about it, but we should. Mm-hmm. Anyway, in 2020, Ellen's parents hired their own pathologist, Dr. Wayne Ross, to examine the sample of spinal cord. And in his examination, he found that not only had her spinal cord been pierced, but it had been severed when she was stabbed in the back of the neck, meaning that it would have been impossible for Ellen to lodge the knife into her own chest, as she would have been immediately paralyzed. But when Assistant District Attorney Guy DeAndrea tried finding Dr. Rourke's original corresponding neuropathology report that she would have, you know, that she would have had to make on Ellen, he was unable to find any such report or anything at all connecting Dr. Rourke to Ellen's autopsy at all, aside from the report done by Dr. Osborne, Assistant Medical Examiner. So Guy DeAndrea contacted Dr. Rourke, and she responded via email, claiming that she had no recollection of ever doing any kind of examination on Ellen's spinal cord at all, nor could she find record of sending out an invoice for her work like she would have needed to do had she done the work that the medical examiner claimed that she did, stating, quote, "I would conclude that I did not see the specimen in question, although there is a remote possibility it was shown to me. However, I have no recollection of such a case," end quote. So she's listed in the autopsy as the one who did the neuropathology report, but there's no proof that she actually did it.
What? Oh, God.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just crazy things. Okay. Guy DeAndrea and Tom Brennan also had some issues with the blood flow that was shown in the crime scene photos. Remember, Ellen was found sitting upright on the floor, leaning against the cabinets in the kitchen, yet she had this horizontal line of blood flowing from her nostril to her left ear, defying gravity, because if she was in that position when that injury occurred, the blood would have flown down into the direction of her mouth, not toward the back of her ear.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't have to say this.
No. Pretty obvious.
To me, this indicates that she was moved from a lying position to the seated position that she was found in.
So is the nostril with the blood coming out of it, is that from the spinal cord sever?
I'm not 100% sure. Her septum was intact, so it's not like she got hit in the nose, right, or anything like that. It's possible, though, it could have come from...
I'm curious because I don't know how accurate this is. I've never looked into it, but I know in like movies and stuff, sometimes when someone's spinal cord snaps, like a line of blood will trail out of their nose. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. I'm curious if she was sideways when he stabbed her in the back of the neck for whatever reason. Or
when who stabbed her in the back of the neck?
Somebody. It wasn't her. It was not her. Okay.
No. So DeAndrea and Brennan were also perplexed at the lack of blood at the scene, because while there was blood, you can see this in like the crime scene photos easily. I'm not going to post the actual crime scene photos because I don't do that. There's not near the amount of blood that you would expect from someone who's been stabbed 20 times, especially considering she was stabbed in places that like bleed very easily, mm-hmm. like her heart.
Yeah.
Okay, she was stabbed in like her aorta her aorta arch, basically. So that would have bled.
Yeah.
So this led both DeAndrea and Brennan to believe that the crime scene was cleaned and then staged. But we would have never known because they never did a luminol test on the scene before allowing it to be professionally cleaned. So, great. Don't know. Dr. Wayne Ross also concluded that Ellen had bruises on her neck that resembled finger markings and small cuts on her neck, as well as a hemorrhage near her throat, which all point to Ellen being manually strangled. A 3D rendering of Ellen's body and her wounds was created, showing the knife going in all different directions, and the trajectory of some of the wounds to the back of her neck and the depth of the wounds would have been impossible for Ellen to accomplish herself. Okay, so let's talk about this locked door, which the locked door is the main reason, aside from the lack of defensive wounds, that caused police to immediately say suicide is the manner of death. So this door has a swing U-lock, which, as we've said before, is basically the kind that you would see in like a hotel room or something like that. I'll post a picture of this specific lock from the Venice Lofts Apartments on our Instagram so you can see the, like, so you can get like the visual of the kind of lock we're talking about. But you can also just Google the U-lock if you feel so inclined. On this particular door, though, it appears the swing is opposite of what I've seen a lot of. Typically, the swing is on the door frame, but in this case, the swing is on the door itself. So Sam claims that he broke the door down to get into the apartment, okay? Simply by force and force alone. Cool. Got it. All right. Here's my issue, though. When you look at the damage done, quote-unquote damage done to this lock, the swing bar on the door frame is completely still intact. And the other part that's on the door, it has like a little bit of damage with the top screw being pulled from the door and the bottom screw being like slightly pulled from the door. But aside from that, the lock is still on the wall. There's not even a lot of damage done to the door itself and no damage done at all to the door frame. So not at all what you would see if someone broke into a door with force.
Yeah.
A YouTuber named Gavin Fish did extensive research on this particular case, and he did a little experiment in his own home where he broke through a door that had the same swing bar lock, and it completely tore off over 2 feet of the door frame, and the swing bar was pulled completely from where it was secured. So there would have been so much more damage had he broke into the apartment.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, and I didn't put it in my notes because I don't need people going and YouTubing it, there are ways to get into that kind of door. You can use, I think it's stupid that you can Google or you can YouTube how to get into a locked hotel room door. That's super fucking creepy.
Ew.
But there are ways, and you can get into a door that has like the swing lock without having it opened from the inside. So just throwing that out there.
Yeah.
And in February of 2017, Josh and Sandy Greenberg filed a right to know request with the police requesting all evidence, but this request was denied. The police commissioner was like, okay, you know, you can go in and review the paperwork, but you can't copy it. You can't photograph it. You can't ask questions, and you can't bring any kind of expert or lawyer who can explain anything to you.
Okay.
These are her parents trying to get her file, and they're basically like, yeah, you can come look at it, but you can't do anything else with it.
Wow. Okay.
So without a legal expert, they weren't really sure what they should be looking for. So, you know, like, what good would that be, you know?
Exactly.
So they can't take notes, can't do anything except for try to remember what they see. If the police are so adamant that this would be a suicide, why the hell would it matter who looks at this? Like, what are you trying to hide?
Yeah, exactly.
In 2018, Larry Krasner was elected district attorney in Philadelphia. And because he was the lawyer of the Greenbergs at the time, he cited a conflict of interest and referred the case to the attorney general, Josh Shapiro. The Greenbergs filed a formal request to reopen Ellen's case and get her manner of death reversed. But this request was also denied, with the state attorney general stating, quote, "We conducted a thorough investigation that did not uncover evidence to change the medical examiner's finding of suicide," end quote. They report that in their investigation, they found searches on Ellen's personal laptop that consisted of methods of committing suicide, euthanasia, quick death, suffocation, and painless suicide in the weeks leading up to her death. I went to a few of these webpages, and most of these weren't even like Google searches. They were like articles that had been clicked on but not searched for. So, I mean, it could have been like she had been Googling, like, or someone had been Googling like the side effects of the medication that she was on. So it's possible that she had like some kind of sponsored ad, like sponsored post or something that she had clicked on or whatever, but she didn't search these out. The painless suicide reference wasn't even like a how-to guide. It was like a very Christian anti-suicide article. And also Ellen was Jewish and very devout in her faith, so not really sure why she would be viewing a Christian website or article, but cool. Guy DeAndrea states that this information was not in files that he had received, and it's to be noted that in 2011, police searched this laptop and there were no such searches found. It was also to be noted that Ellen did not have a password protection on her laptop. So if these searches did in fact happen, who's to say that it was her who made them?
Yeah.
But I think it's pretty damning how when police looked in 2011, the searches weren't there. It's in the report that there was no evidence of suicidal ideation found on the laptop. And then Sam Goldberg. And then Sam Goldberg's uncle took the laptop. No clue whose hands it was in after that until police got it back. But suddenly now there are all of these searches on it.
Yeah.
That doesn't really make any sense to me. And also, since the chain of evidence was broken, how are you going to say that this is part of the reasoning you're deciding to keep the manner of death a suicide? Also, let's just say, for instance, she did search up painless suicide. Why would she choose the most painful way to do it in the end?
Yeah.
While knowing there were less painful ways to go about it.
Nothing about that makes any sense whatsoever.
On October 15th, 2019, the Greenbergs sued the medical examiner's office, as well as Marlon Osborne, the medical examiner who performed Ellen's autopsy, asking them to officially change the manner of death from suicide to at least undetermined or homicide. New details emerged with the lawsuit, and that includes the fact that according to the neuropathologist who testified, that the wound and the sample that remains from Ellen's spine is a post-mortem wound. Meaning, she was dead already whenever she received at least one of her wounds. So if you consider that, you know, that was not the last wound, because the knife was found in her chest, you have to agree that Ellen, while she was dead, somehow proceeded to stab herself in the back of the head, pull the knife out, and then stab herself in the chest, all without a pulse.
Yeah. No.
Evidence also suggested that she suffered stab wounds in two different knives, but only the one stuck in her chest was recovered and taken in as evidence. The others from the home were never tested for DNA that could have been cleaned off. During a 2021 deposition as part of a civil lawsuit the Greenbergs filed over the suicide designation, former medical examiner Dr. Sam Galino testified that he'd received no complaints about Dr. Marlon Osborne. But department records showed Osborne was named in at least three reprimands, according to Tom Brennan. And one, his supervisor, Dr. Gary Collins, pointed out serious and dangerous flaws in Osborne's autopsy work, including missing the signs of manual strangulation on a victim who, in paragraphs, clearly had been strangled, among other mistakes. Not in paragraphs, in photographs. Sorry, my autocorrected it from photographs to paragraphs. And this makes sense considering manual strangulation was not found in Ellen's original autopsy, despite multiple experts who viewed it after the fact saw clear indication of strangulation. On January 26, 2011, 10 years after Ellen's death, the Greenbergs' current attorney revealed that a forensic evaluation of Ellen's laptop hard drive proved the searches that were found on her laptop were never actually made on her laptop. Joe Pedraza, the Greenbergs' current attorney, sent this new information to the Attorney General's office in an attempt for them to reopen the case. And a spokesperson for the Attorney General told Eyewitness News in a statement the following day, quote, "Our hearts go out to the Greenberg family on the anniversary of Ellen's traumatic death, as the urging of the family and following conflict referral from the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office in 2018, our office reviewed the case and conducted an extensive investigation that did not uncover evidence to change the medical examiner's finding to suicide. There is no statute of limitation on homicide, however, and if any new evidence is brought forward, we believe it should be reviewed by the proper authorities, but at this time, no such information has been shared with our office," end quote. On July 8th, 2022, the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office referred the case back to the Philadelphia District Attorney's office due to accusations of conflict of interest. So they're just going back and forth, sending this case back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, because they don't want to deal with it. The Philadelphia District Attorney then referred the case to the Chester County District Attorney's office, who issued this statement, quote, "Our office has accepted this referral from the Philadelphia District Attorney's office. We have assigned an investigator and prosecutor to review it. And as of February of 2023, the investigation is still underway through the Chester County District Attorney's office. So it seems as if possibly the correct eyes are finally looking at the case. Ellen's family has been working tirelessly for the last 12 years to get Ellen's case properly looked into. They should not have to beg officials to give a shit about their daughter. Mm-mm. I will be linking the Greenbergs GoFundMe that they have created to assist in the mounting legal fees that they have accumulated over the last decade. If you would like to donate to the family, that's great. But if not, which is totally fine, I will also be linking the change.org petition for justice for Ellen. If you don't have the extra funds to donate to the GoFundMe, totally get it. I highly recommend taking a few moments to sign the petition. While her case may be under investigation again, the signing of the petition shows the Greenberg family just how many supporters they have and that they're not in this alone, even if it may feel like it based on, how they've been treated this far. So Ellen Greenberg was a light to this world, and her death should not be swept under the rug for convenience or to cover up for whoever may have done this. That is the case of Ellen Rae Greenberg.
Wow. Yeah, no, not a suicide.
Fully believe it. Not a suicide whatsoever.
Wow. While you were talking, I was looking up some things about it, and I saw some diagrams, 3D models of the way that she was stabbed, showing
yes.
It showed multiple knives, even though, just to show where the stab wounds were. It's 10 knives yes. around the back of her head and some more in her torso. And I'm like, how could anybody look at this and think that's a suicide? It's you wouldn't make it that long to give yourself that many stab wounds in those places. Jeez.
Yeah, there's no way. And I'll probably post pictures of the 3D rendition of it. I'll put a trigger warning before if you don't want to see it. It's a 3D model. It's not an actual crime scene photo.
Right. Yeah.
But just so... just so people can see what actually happened. So
yeah, poor family.
I know. I felt so bad for her family whenever I was reading through everything. It's just, I can't imagine something happening to my daughter and me being the only one who wants to find out what happened.
Yeah. All the authorities, all the people that are supposed to help you don't seem to care.
Yep.
What a world.
Well, this is one case that I want to know what you guys think about it. Let us know your theories, your opinions. Let us know what you think about, what happened and what you think could have happened.
Yeah.
You can comment on our Instagram post about it on our Instagram, obviously, which is the Morning Hour Pod. You can find us on Facebook, which is the Morning Hour Podcast. Just search us up. If you have any case suggestions, requests, or just want to talk to us, you can email us at themorninghourpod@gmail.com. If you want to check out our Buy Me a Coffee, our merch, our case files section, all that kind of good stuff, you can go to our website, which is themorninghourpodcast.com. We love you guys so much. Thank you for listening. I know this was a heavy one, but they're all heavy, honestly. So
true.
Thank you for sticking with us. We love you guys.
Well,
so that being said, we will see you in our next one. Well, no, you might not see us, but you'll hear us. Okay, guys. Bye.
Bye.